This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his years at National Public Radio, John Hockenberry covered some extraordinary stories: the Intifada, the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and the mass migration of Kurdish refugees after the Gulf War. When he filed his reports, he followed a code to never acknowledge that he was unable to walk, that he got around in a wheelchair, and often experienced harrowing moments in pursuit of a deadline. Hockenberry breaks his code by telling those behind-the-scenes stories in his new memoir, Moving Violations, War Zones, Wheelchairs, and Declarations of Independence. In addition to his work as an NPR foreign correspondent, Hockenberry also worked as a frequent host of All Things Considered, host of the late-night program Heat, and the first host of Talk of the Nation. For the past couple of years, he's reported for the ABC news magazine Day One. It was a car accident that left him paralyzed from the mid-chest down. One of the most challenging moments since the accident was when he was covering the flight of the Kurds from Iraq after the Gulf War. To cover the story, he had to leave his wheelchair with a cab driver and ride a donkey across a mountain.
We knew that there was a refugee exodus, and some of us got into a charter airplane. I remember in Turkey there was a strike for the domestic airlines, so it was incredibly difficult. All the logistics were incredibly difficult. And so we chartered a plane, went to a place called Van in eastern Turkey, and then in a cab we drove from Van to a place called Hakkari, which is in the mountains, and then we got into another cab. And as we were driving from Hakkari to the border, the roads got worse and worse and worse, and it was muddy and yucky and terrible, and the infrastructure was just completely breaking down. And it was also very, very clear to me, just quietly staring out the window, that at some point the infrastructure was going to, you know, be at a level where you weren't going to be able to roll around in a chair outside of that car. And I think my companions, I was with a journalist from the Independent newspaper and someone from Reuters, and those two individuals were kind of wondering, so what's going to happen with this guy here? I mean, so what are we going to have to do here? And so I had to have a plan. I absolutely had to have a plan. And there was only one plan. And that was, you know, there were a lot of donkeys around. And I just figured, well, you know, I've never been on a donkey. I have no idea how I would stay on a donkey. But I presume I can just sort of wing it. And so, indeed, when we got to the end of the road at the Zab River, where there's this little rickety bridge, the only way to go at that point was to walk, and that wasn't what I was going to do. So I said, you know, hey, how much for that donkey in the window? And, you know, it was like $30 or something for the day. And I hopped on the back and left my chair with the cabbie, who said, you know, I'll see you tomorrow. And off we went.
Now, if that would have been me, I would be flashing onto all the things that could go wrong. The cabbie absconds with the chair, I get back, I don't have a chair. Or I fall off the donkey and it's too hard to ride and I'm just stranded in the middle of nowhere. Did you not have thoughts like that?
Well, the thoughts I had were, if I make it all the way to here and I'm still two mountain ranges away from the story, I might as well have stayed home. And that thought was the primary motivating factor. I mean, there was just no way I wasn't going to absolutely take it to the limit. You know, to have spent all that energy to get to that point, you know, you were committed. You had to go all the way. There was no other choice.
So when you were taking this donkey ride, you were surrounded by, you know, hundreds of thousands of Kurdish refugees who were starving and frightened and totally unsure about their future. But did you need to rely on them for help at any point?
Well, I was, you know, just going to the story. And on the way up, it was actually very deserted and it was very beautiful looking at the mountains. When we finally got to Uzumlu, which was this town where just across the border, then we were surrounded by refugees. And indeed, the Turkish soldiers were up there already sort of shooing the refugees down off the highlands. So this stream began to come towards the donkey. And people looked at me on the donkey, especially some of the women, because, you know, they were with their families and they didn't have much food, and they were wondering why this, you know, healthy, white, blonde American, you know, strapping specimen of a guy was sitting on this donkey when it should have been carrying some food maybe, or some of the bodies of the people who were dying up there. And so they would ask, you know, what the heck's going on here? Why is he up there? Why is he having this comfortable ride?
And the guide who was with me indicated that I couldn't walk. And I, you know, with my own bad Arabic could indicate that I wasn't able to walk. And then, you know, everything changed. Here, these individuals were, you know, completely uprooted from their homes, and they're going, you know, you can't walk. My God, what are you doing here? It's very dangerous here. You should go back. You know, are you lost? What's the deal? And my initial response was, well, hey, I'm here, you know, doing a job and don't need any help. And then it sort of suddenly hit me that, you know, these people weren't nuts. You know, I mean, they're right. I actually, it is kind of dangerous to be here, and it's not great to not be able to walk here, and I better know what I'm doing. And it was very frightening to me because I thought to myself, you know, am I here for them, or am I just trying to prove some, you know, win some sort of athletic medal? Am I trying to prove something to me, or am I here for a reason? And I was actually so frightened by the thought that I might just be here just to, you know, prove something to John, that I remember I stopped the donkey at that moment, sat down in the mud with my tape deck, cross-legged, and, you know, did interviews for like an hour and a half with people just to make sure that I was listening to them and that this had nothing to do with me.
You know, it seems to me that in your work as a foreign correspondent for National Public Radio, that you got to see a different side of people than a lot of other reporters might have seen, because, in part because they helped you and saw you as a person and not just as a reporter. I mean, if there were a lot of times when you needed to interview somebody who was on the fifth floor of a walk-up, and people would carry you up. You write in your book about an extremist Israeli ultranationalist who you got to know pretty well before he told you a lot about the group that he worked with. And he really treated, something very embarrassing happened, which I won't go into, but he treated you really well and really respectfully as a person. And you saw a side of him that you might not have seen if you were just going in to get the story of an extremist.
Well, what I discovered again and again in the Middle East, and what I've discovered all over, you know, during this time of being a reporter for 15 years now, that, you know, my crazy sense of, hey, I'm going to go wherever I need to go, you know, to people where I show up, to them, it's a kind of a, you know, thank you for telling me about yourself. I think I'll return the favor and tell you something about myself. And that was true. I remember interviewing Neil Young one time, and, you know, he was extremely taciturn and, you know, did not want to do the interview, and was coming into NPR, and he was going to be there for 5 minutes, and all he wanted to do was talk about Farm Aid or something like that. And he sat down in the studio with me, and he has two disabled children. And, you know, we were suddenly talking about wheelchairs and what's the good ones and what's the bad ones. And this went on long before they even started recording. And then we started recording, and it was a terrific interview just because, you know, we had something as human beings in common to talk about. And that happened again and again and again in the Middle East and all throughout my career. And, I don't know, it's something about sticking out from the crowd, you know, being different, but also bringing something of yourself because you have to into the situation, people want to return the favor.
John Hockenberry is my guest, formerly with NPR, now with ABC TV, and he has a new memoir called Moving Violations, a memoir of war zones, wheelchairs, and declarations of independence. Well, you had a Palestinian friend named Radwan who became paraplegic, I think, because of a bullet wound. And you became pretty close with him, even eventually made a wheelchair for him that would be a lot better than the clunky one that he had. But I want you to tell the story of the terrorist who killed in the name of your friend.
Well, there were so many times when, you know, my relationship to the wheelchair provided little details that ended up to be relevant to the news. And this was one case that was so particularly chilling. I mean, I made friends with Radwan almost immediately after I arrived in the Middle East in 1988. I went to Maqasid Hospital in East Jerusalem, and I went up there and was talking with some of the spinal cord injured people. And he was one of the first people injured at the beginning of the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. And he had an injury right very similar to mine. Mine was a car accident. His was a bullet wound, but it was the same vertebrae, about T5. So physically, we were about the same. And so the things I could do, theoretically, he could do. And I met him. He was lying in a hospital bed, and he was surrounded by young boys. And one in particular, who appeared to be a religious student, Abdul Hadi was his name, he would speak for Radwan. And I would look at Radwan, and I would say, you know, how come you're not in the bed. I mean, I wouldn't say that to him literally, but that's what my eyes would say. And, you know, he would look at me, how do I get to be what you are? And Abdul Hadi would say, he's a great hero. He's a martyr of the Intifada. He's a martyr against the Israelis. And I could tell that this had nothing to do with Radwan, and I didn't want to hear it. And I mostly wanted to know why he couldn't get in and out of bed by himself. And so over time, we became friends, and I would go and visit him when his friends weren't around. And I would show him how to get into the bed and get out of the bed. And when they finally gave him a wheelchair, this piece of junk from the Soviet bloc, that the Palestinians would always buy their wheelchairs from the Soviet bloc because that was their Cold War vendor. And the Israelis would always buy American chairs. So the Israelis had great wheelchairs and the Palestinians had just garbage wheelchairs. So I had this extra chair that I had brought with me, and I refixed it and refashioned it and gave it to Radwan. And so Radwan went home to Gaza, where he lived, one weekend. And the next week, and I said, you know, see you later. And I was giving Radwan his chair, and it had these two wheels on the front. I don't know if you can quite imagine. The wheels that I have on the front, the little wheels, you know what I mean? The little caster wheels on the front of the chair that aren't the big wheels. You can get different kinds of wheels on a chair. And the ones that I gave him were these real, they were neoprene. They were really small casters, kind of like you would find on rollerblades. And because they were the only ones I had. And they were terrible for sand. And where Radwan lived in Gaza was just all sand. And he looked at them and he said, you know, John, those are bad wheels for sand. And I said, yeah, I know. I'll get you some other wheels, you know, when I see you again. So he goes home to Gaza. And a week later, this young man, some young man, came over on the wires, had driven a bus off of a cliff on the road leading into Jerusalem. He basically grabbed the wheel of an Israeli a regular bus, the Jerusalem to Tel Aviv bus that goes every day, you know, several times a day, crowded bus, and he grabbed the wheel and screamed something, and the bus went off the cliff, and, you know, many people died. I think 12 people died, and it was, you know, it was a very, very big story at the time. And the wires reported it, and the Israeli media reported it, that he had screamed Allahu Akbar, which was something common that so-called Islamic fundamentalist terrorists would say when they would commit an act like this. Allahu Akbar in Arabic means, you know, God is great. And I went to the hospital. I remember I was interviewing people who were injured, and there were some Arabs on the bus. And they said to me, you know, I said, what did he yell? And trying to confirm the details of the Israeli account. And they, I said, did he yell Allahu Akbar when he grabbed the wheel? And the Palestinians, to a person, said, no, it wasn't Allahu Akbar. He yelled a name, Radwan, or something. And I remember, you know, there was no particular reason for me to think that it had anything to do with anything else. But it was at that moment in Hadassah Hospital in Israel that I realized, oh, my God, it all came together for me. And indeed, when I looked at the Israeli police report of the interrogation of this guy, he had done it for his friend, Radwan. And the name was Radwan Abu Shmesh, and it was the same guy. It was my friend, and they lived in Gaza. And he had been with him that weekend in Gaza and had seen him in the chair moving around, having extreme difficulty moving. And it made him crazy. And this was the same guy who had seen him many, many times in the hospital, who was very comfortable with him lying sedentary and, to my mind, dead in the hospital. But with him up and struggling in the sand, it made him so angry that he committed this act.
My guest is journalist John Hockenberry. He's written a new memoir called Moving Violations. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist John Hockenberry. He worked at NPR for over a decade, then moved to ABC TV. John, you write about how much you wanted to go to Iraq, go to Baghdad during the Gulf War, and your editors didn't want to send you. Your editors from NPR wouldn't let you go there. And you were very angry with them at the time.
You know, I was like a lot of reporters during the Gulf War. You know, there's this, some idea that you're going to get into the center of ground zero and you're going to just somehow gain some insight and that's going to be really important for the rest of your life. And I wanted to go there, and I knew a lot of people who were there. And I remember my editor, Cotty Simon, who's just one of the most wonderful people in the world and who has indulged my insanity for more than I could say, said to me one day, and I write about it in the book, she said, John, you know, if you get a visa to Iraq, you have to give it to another reporter who's there. And I said, why? And I was very, very angry over the whole thing. And she said, John, you know, we asked people at the Rashid Hotel, we asked, you know, ABC and CNN if they would help you when you get there because you're in a wheelchair and all that. And we just want to make sure that they'll help you. And they said, what? You're sending someone in a wheelchair, you know, to this part of the world? You know, you must be out of your mind. And so that said to them that, you know, I was kind of on my own and they wanted me to know that. Of course, from my perspective, you know, that's not how things work. You just sort of go and you meet your friends and no one's going to just leave you in the lurch. But what they had discovered, which was crucial to them, was that the elevators didn't work at the Rashid Hotel, something which, I mean, obviously was the case. I mean, I knew that the elevators didn't work. So the idea that the elevators didn't work at that hotel was absolutely no inhibition to me to go there. But they said, John, the elevators don't work. And I remember saying to Cotty, Cotty, do you know how many places I've been for you where the elevators didn't work? Or something like that. And I remember at that point, it was clear I wasn't going. It was also completely clear to me that the reason I wanted to go had nothing to do with the war. And so at that point, I knew I wasn't going. And I remember I was very, very emotional. It was just very, very painful for me to realize this, that I had sort of, you know, violated the first rule of a story, and that is kind of, you know, you're there for the wrong reason.
What was the reason you wanted to go?
I just wanted, you know, to get up there. You know, I was going to be there too with everyone else. And I was wrong. I mean, that was wrong as a journalist, and it was, you know, it was a mistake I had not ever made before. But I just was too much, you know, it was about me. It wasn't about Baghdad. It wasn't about Iraq. It wasn't about U.S. policy in the Persian Gulf. And so while NPR's reasons for not sending me were wrong, my reasons for wanting to go, I think, were perhaps even more wrong. And I didn't put it all together until I went to Kurdistan and realized that, John, you know, you didn't miss anything, you know. And you certainly weren't going to ever miss anything here. You know, you miss things when you're not listening and watching. And at that moment, on that phone line with Cotty, my editor, I was not listening and watching. I was sort of involved in a struggle of my own. But it was a very painful moment, I remember. But I was so glad I learned that lesson and then was able to learn, you know, in Kurdistan that, you know, you don't have to go to ground zero. You don't have to, you know, to do the cliche. You know, there's much more subtlety in the world.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of your memoir, Moving Violations. And this is the part where you describe the car accident that you were in that left you disabled. So you want to read that part?
Sure. This is I was hitchhiking across the country and coming from my college in Chicago with my college roommate, and we were going to visit his girlfriend in Massachusetts. And it had been a dreadful hitchhiking trip anyway, even before anyone got disabled, or in the case of the woman who was driving, killed. And then we got in this car, and we fell asleep in the back seat, Rick and I, my roommate and I. We were very, very tired. And when we woke up, we realized that the driver had fallen asleep in the front seat and that we were going off the road. And, you know, a few minutes later, we were at the bottom of a 200-foot embankment. And, you know, the rest is history. But I'll start sort of, this is the moment right after the accident, or some description of that. People always ask whose fault it was. It seems such an odd question, and yet for me, the answer is just a shrug. I was hitchhiking from Chicago to Massachusetts with my college roommate. We got into a car in Pennsylvania on a sunny February day. I fell asleep in the back seat. The driver and her college roommate fell asleep in the front seat. When I awoke, our car had snapped the thread holding it to earth. We hurtled over a flimsy guardrail and down an embankment. The steel of the roof crumpled on first impact, and the car's subsequent rolls and bounces rammed the frame of the passenger compartment into my back again and again. Four times, I counted, and then it came to rest. I sat pinned in that car for a long time, feeling the life bleed out of me in a warm puddle that made my hands slippery, that covered my face with the dripping, sticky confirmation that I was very seriously injured. I made a solitary attempt to leave the car, placing my hands on my knees in an effort to push off and straighten up. My hands felt my knees, but the sensation was not returned. The knees were warm and clearly mine. yet I could no longer feel them. It is that exact moment and that precise memory that divides my life into the time when my legs carried me and the time I have spent carrying those same legs. As these words are written, the moment falls at the exact midpoint of my life, 19 years on either side. Upon touching those knees and feeling the sensation only in my hands, I knew my spinal cord had been severed. Whatever else was wrong with me, I would not walk again. The most powerful sensation I have ever felt is of no sensation at all.
Well, how much thinking did you do while you were waiting for the ambulance? I should say you were conscious the whole time. So were you thinking, well, what's the rest of my life going to be like?
Well, you sort of, I mean, it was so completely strange. I was in this car, very trapped. I was having difficulty breathing. And for a while, there was some pain, and then it sort of went away, and you begin to float. And I think that I was sort of losing it. I didn't lose consciousness, but I was very, very conscious that I was going away. I mean, there was a very clear point at which I was kind of looking at this poor guy in the car who was injured, and, you know, poor guy. I mean, I guess he'll never walk again, or, you know, hope he's okay. And I lost the sensation that it was even me. And then you get this sort of sense of complete well-being. I remember looking up and seeing this little patch of blue through whatever hole in the car there was that I could see out of. And I remember thinking, okay, you know, I guess I don't have to worry about all those things that I worry about, you know, like my penmanship or the fact that I was probably going to flunk Russian literature or something. And I remember feeling, why didn't I think of this before? You know, it's so great to know that you don't have to worry so much all the time. And I think that it wasn't until they actually put some oxygen on my face when the paramedics finally got there and they had to saw this car apart to get me to the oxygen and everything, that I began to come back and feel a little more real. But I thought about a lot of things. I remember, okay, so I can move my hands, and I was squeezing them and making fists. And every once in a while, I would touch my knees again, and I'd go, yeah, God, they're gone. Huh. Well, and there was a kind of, early on, there was a feeling of like, you know, uh-oh, guess I'm really screwed up now. I mean, there was a sort of a feeling of, you know, you're in trouble now. I mean, it really was quite juvenile sort of feeling. I mean, when you just sort of, you know, you spilled the milk and, you know, mommy's going to catch you. I mean, there was something absolutely inevitable about what was happening there. You know, you weren't going to get out of it. I mean, I think as a child, especially as a teenager, you have some idea that, you know, you're going to squeak by, or you're not going to study for the exam, and you're going to get an A anyway, you know, stuff like that. And this was one of those experiences where, no, pal, you know.
Journalist John Hockenberry, this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with journalist John Hockenberry. In his new memoir, Moving Violations, he tells what it's taken to get the story and meet the deadline without being able to walk. Hockenberry has been paralyzed from the mid-chest down ever since a 1976 car accident. He spent over a decade with NPR as a general assignment reporter, Middle East correspondent, host of the late-night program Heat, and is the first host of Talk of the Nation. For the past couple of years, he's worked with the ABC News magazine Day One. Hockenberry was in college at the time of his accident. He says he emerged from physical therapy an angry young man.
I guess I probably was the angry young man to a lot of people, but you're on autopilot. I mean, you're really just sort of in your own world completely. And I think what I discovered was that the trauma I was going through in trying to figure out how to walk and roll over and sit up and, you know, and the fact that everyone was staring at me now and how I was going to deal with all of that was very different from what my friends and family were going through. I mean, they were seeing, you know, their loved one completely differently. I mean, you know, my mother, for years after the accident, would look at me and, you know, she'd get this weird expression on her face. And I'd say, what are you thinking? And she says, oh, I just was wondering if maybe you'd stand up and walk over to me. You know, and I'd go, jeez.
You mean like so they were waiting for the miracle?
So they weren't waiting for the miracle. It was just like, that's how they knew me. That's what I did. There was no sort of internal cue that was saying to them, he's paralyzed. I mean, they couldn't fathom why I couldn't stand up. Whereas for me, I knew I couldn't stand up. I mean, I couldn't feel my feet. I had to drag him around. I mean, it was absolutely real to me that I couldn't stand up. I remember there was one time we had this record on, in the living room. I was lying on this couch or this bed or something that they had in this living room where I was right after the accident. And when you have a spinal cord injury, you don't completely lose the ability to move. You can't control the motions, but your feet will sometimes be spastic, and your legs might, you know, jerk a little bit here and there. And this music was on, and my foot, you know, which she could see on top of the sheet or something, it was like moving, and it was moving to the music. You know, it was moving exactly in time to the music. You know, and I saw it, and I thought that was kind of, you know, funny. But my mother saw it, and she went, John, look at your foot. You know, it's like tapping out, you know, some top 40 tune. And, you know, I said, Mom, my foot can't hear. You know, I mean, there's really no way that my foot can hear that music. But, you know, it's just this, for them, it doesn't make sense that I can't walk. Whereas for me, I mean, that's sort of the difference between the two experiences. For me, it makes perfect sense that I can't walk. I understand. Physiologically, that's the person that I am. For them, you know, I'm sort of this guy that walked for a while and then doesn't anymore. That's harder, I think, to fathom sometimes.
You ended up, as we all know, becoming a journalist, first a radio journalist. And so, I mean, it seems like radio in a way was the perfect medium for you because it allowed you to use your writing gifts. You had a physical presence in radio as a voice, but no one could see the wheelchair, so no one could fixate on the fact like, oh, well, he's in a wheelchair. What does that mean? Is he different? Blah, blah, blah. You moved to television a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I'm completely out of the closet now.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I'm wondering what your kind of personal guidelines have been about when like the wheelchair should be on camera and when it shouldn't be, and when you should be seated at like a regular chair, and when you want to be seated in the wheelchair when your seat is on camera.
Well, I used to have, my personal guideline was sort of related to other Crips, you know. I mean, if people are shooting me too tight and the chair isn't in there, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to get in all kinds of trouble if this entire piece, it's just my head, okay? Because, you know, people will call up and they'll go, you know, you're in denial, man. You know, you're, like, not showing the chair. And, like, you know, that's a problem. And the other thing is that, you know, you want people to see the chair so that they can kind of check out your equipment. Because people in wheelchairs, when they see each other, they like check out. Okay, he's in a quickie, right? He's got 20-inch wheels. There is cambered. Okay, armrests. No armrests. That's cool. You know, I mean, you're sort of evaluating. It's like kind of on the street what happens on 125th Street where people are looking at each other's shoes and stuff. And so my reasons for having the chair in the shot or not relate a lot to my peers, my Crip peers.
Journalist John Hockenberry is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Moving Violations. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist John Hockenberry. One of the things I really like about your memoir, John, Moving Violations, is the tone that you have. You know, you're describing some things that are, you know, very painful, that are very difficult, and you often are describing it in a very absurdist, often ironic tone. And there's a lot of deep feeling and a lot of humor simultaneously in your descriptions. And I'm wondering if you were always able to tell your story in that kind of multidimensional tone and what it took to get there, what previous drafts might have been like, what tones they took.
Well, I think in some ways this book has been a constant running monologue in my, you know, day-to-day life. I mean, stuff will happen to you that it's just insane. You know, people will come up and ask you the most outlandish questions, or you will just get into situations that are so completely insane. There's one story in here that just sort of typifies it completely. I was rolling down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and it was back when I was doing NPR in Chicago, and I come, and I'm going fast, and I love to go fast, and I'm going up the hill, and I'm just like, nothing can hurt me. I'm like cruising really fast, and I'm weaving around pedestrians and having a great time. It's a beautiful day. And I roll out across, I think it's Wacker Drive or something that crosses Michigan Avenue. And this bus is turning right. And I'm down low, and the bus is already into its turn. And, you know, I still got a walk sign. And, you know, I'm always kind of pushing it. I'm like, you know, I'm not going to stop just because a bus is turning, you know, right? And so I get out there, and I realize once I'm out in the street that the bus is into its turn, and it can't see me, and it's not going to stop turning. And now the big bus wheel, which is about
4'11", I mean, it's a very big bus wheel, is coming straight for me. And it's not going to stop. And I certainly have to acknowledge the bus, but then very, very quickly, it's like the bus is going to run over me. And so I had like literally 2 seconds to just jump from my chair. I just jumped, and all I could do was jump with my arms because I couldn't jump with my legs, and I had to just grab my legs and hope that I'd pulled them away from the chair, and the bus runs right over the chair and just crunches it, and the wheels pop and everything, and suddenly I'm sitting in the middle of the street cross-legged looking at my chair literally under the wheel. The people on the street, these pedestrians on the street, are screaming. I mean, this is unfathomable what happened. I mean, I'm perfectly fine, but I mean, literally in their mind, somebody in a wheelchair just got run over by a bus right in front of me. And I was sitting there and I was watching it. Oh, my God. And they're screaming and yelling. And the people on the bus can kind of see me, you know, disappear under the bus. And so they're going, oh, my God, I think a guy in a wheelchair is underneath the bus. So they're like freaking out. And the only person that has no idea what's going on is the bus driver. And she, you know, comes out. And I can see the bus door open and I can see her head. I mean, she sort of heard snippets undoubtedly of what's going on. Wheelchair, under the bus. Oh, my God, you ran over. Guy in a wheelchair, under the bus. And she sort of, I can see her head sort of slowly come out. And she sees me and makes eye contact. And I look at her, hi. You know, and she looks at the chair. And she looks at me. And she goes, you know, are you all right? You know, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. But the chair's kind of ruined. And you could just see the relief on her face. But here's this crazy predicament. People called an ambulance. An ambulance comes, and these paramedics jump out. They see a bus here. They see a wheelchair under the bus. The guy run over to me and said, are you all right? And I said, I said, yeah, I'm absolutely fine. And they go, can you walk? No, I can't walk. Oh, my God. And so they get the stretcher, and they come here. You can't walk? Are you sure you can't walk? And I said, but I haven't been able to walk for years. And I said, and they were completely stymied by this. I mean, it was just, you know, the fact that I wasn't hurt meant that they couldn't help me. But all these kinds of outlandish, ridiculous, crazy things that happen to you when you're suddenly so different in a world that's ostensibly normal, it just makes for all kinds of just situations that you just sort of scratch your head and go, oh, God.
Well, let me get back to the tone, though. Let me get back to the tone. That story in your book is horrifying and comic at the same time.
See, I think it's totally comic, but other people read it and they go, it's totally horrifying.
Well, it's horrifying and comic. I mean, how can you not be horrified by it, by nearly getting hit by a bus and having your wheelchair underneath the wheels of the bus? I mean, that's...
I was sad for the chair. I remember when the chair was broken, I remember feeling like...
You can't tell me your heart wasn't beating a little bit fast when that was over. But anyways, how did the story get to the point in your mind where it had that comic edge to it? I bet, you know, if you told the story to me an hour after you got home, it probably wouldn't have been very funny.
But it was really funny then. That was the thing.
It was
just, how can I be sitting here cross-legged, absolutely fine, surrounded by a bunch of screaming people, having just gotten run over by a bus? I mean, that's what was so comic. It's just, it made completely no sense. But it's those kinds of disconnections that make it hard to come up with a tone. Sometimes you don't want to be so somber about this stuff because, in a sense, a lot of the meaning in it is the humor.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's really meaningful about it is this the fact that you're different and you're sort of bumping into things. And that's as important as the tragedy, because the tragedy is the sort of idea of ending, you know, okay, you used to be able to walk, you can't walk anymore. You know, you've lived for a while, now you're dead. I mean, tragedy is about ending, but this humor is all about beginnings. And so much began at the moment of my accident.
What began?
I mean, in some ways my entire life began. I mean, it's impossible for me to imagine. I mean, I even say this in the book, that if I had gotten in a different car or had started an hour later on that hitchhiking trip, I would have missed my accident. And I can literally feel like, oh, God, if I had done that, I would have been really a mess.
Who do you think you would have been?
I can't even, on some level, I mean, remembering back what I was doing in college, you know, just kind of trying to space my way through and hustle my way through college, very confused guy. You know, I think I would have just, you know, stumbled into some job, and I don't think I would have been as ambitious necessarily. So I think what the accident did was it made me very clear about what I had to do next, something which I probably wouldn't have had at age 19 if I hadn't had the accident. But what I would have been, you know, at this point in my life, I can't even say. Some people who know me, who've known me before the accident and afterwards, I'll ask them, I say, you know, am I different? You know, they say, you know, you're shorter. That's what they say. And so their perception is very much that, you know, nothing would have changed. And so I think, you know, in many ways, it's all sort of mixed up together. And I'm sort of the person I would have always been.
John Hockenberry, his new memoir is called Moving Violations. This is Fresh Air.